Welcome to the Jefferson County Public Hospital District Number 2 Board of Commissioners meeting on Wednesday, July 28th, 2021. This meeting will consist of three parts: board governance education from 2 until 2:15, board education from 2:15 to 3:15, when we will take a 15-minute break and reconvene at 3:30 for our business portion. The session is being officially audio recorded and times shown on the agenda are estimates only. This virtual meeting is being held under Governor Inslee's COVID-19 Notice of Proclamation 2028, and there will be no live public comment period. Our community members are welcome to comment on any item or concern via a letter addressed to the commissioners at 834 Sheridan Street, Port Townsend, 98368, or via email to commissioners at jeffersonhealthcare.org. I now call for a move to approve today's agenda. Do we have such a motion?
So move.
Second.
All right, so moved and seconded. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Hearing none, it passes. So we will move right on into our governance education portion. And what we're going to do is introduce our board retreat on August 9th. The time and the place are to be determined, but the purpose of the retreat is to introduce and discuss several items regarding planning as well as other topics the board would like to discuss. Mike, I think, has some ideas of some of the discussion items. And we will keep you informed as soon as we have a location nailed down. So, Mike, would you go ahead?
Yeah, but let me begin with nailing down the location. The retreat will be held at a conference room at the Port Ludlow Inn, which we felt was large enough to safely social distance and in the region, and we have had leadership retreats at the Port Ludlow Inn before, and it's very conducive to this sort of thing. So Alyssa will send to you before the end of the week sort of the details, but 8:30, 9 o'clock start time, light breakfast, content in the morning, a lunch, and then content in the afternoon, and we expect it to conclude late afternoon, kind of depending on what we decide here. So more specifics to follow, but Monday the 9th, Port Ludlow Inn, 8:30, 9 o'clock start time, and go till mid afternoon. The couple of things that I wanted more focused time to talk with you about, I guess they pertain to the strategic plan. First and foremost is the work that we're doing related to our master site plan. And we have been talking, we've been talking about with the board the need for new and expanded space to meet the growing need for women's health clinic, dermatology and some other specialty services, as well as ambulatory surgery centers. That need is continuing to grow and become more and more acute. So that is still there, and that planning process is continuing. When we brought on our consultants to help us, it was very important that the design of this building be made in the context of a greater campus plan, so that the placement, the look, the feel, the patient flow of this building be plotted sensibly and in close relationship with what we think the hospital replacement project is going to look like that we need to complete in the next couple of years. So the more we talked about that, the consultant said, you know, we should probably, our planning should probably take a couple of different tracks. One track being, because the best way to logically connect that building and those services to your next building is to connect that building and those services to your next building. That we are doing some work to try to imagine what that would look like, and other important details like what the cost of that be, and the timeline, and many other things. Part of the retreat is I wanted to go through that discussion with you in a much more detailed fashion, because with respect to our campus, this decision or these series of decisions, and we certainly won't be getting close to making it a week from Monday, but the decision about where and how these buildings fit and where the replacement project sits on the campus will be crucial, I think, to the next decade or two for the hospital. And I'm interested in your thoughts. I'm interested in sharing with you our thoughts in sort of like a 9 to 18 month period of what different options we have available to us. So rather than try to cram that into administrator's report or even an educational portion of the board meeting, I thought it would be best to have your undivided and captive attention for an hour or so with drawings and schematics and maybe even some engineering reports some experts in some of the areas that I just have superficial knowledge of. So the goal would be to share with you our thinking about go forward from a campus design perspective beyond just the building we've been talking about, seeking your initial thoughts on our thinking thus far, answering questions or maybe getting questions from you that need to be answered, and just begin to lay the foundation of what's going to be a pretty important decision that we'll be making in the next 9 to 12 months. So that's one. The second thing I wanted to spend more focused time with you on is we have, as we are getting closer to completing the second draft-ish of our strategic plan to present to you, we are really focused on a couple of intersecting issues. One is developing systems and processes to help us do our work that are more at the scale of the size and complexity of the organization that we are today and not 8 to 10 years ago. I think I told many of you this individually that we came to this realization before COVID, when things just started to feel like they were fraying, systems were starting to fray a little bit, and that our usual tactics of just working harder and running faster and being more resourceful wasn't as effective. And then it just dawned on us that these systems that many of them were put into place 10, 15 years ago when the organization had 250, 350 employees, and we're about a $45, $50 million place. And fast forward today, we are a 900-employee organization and $125 million place with a far bigger footprint. And at some point, you truly need to be really deliberate about the management processes and systems that you have in place, that everything to do from employee leadership evaluations, employee evaluations, employee leadership rounding, communication strategies, kind of all this stuff that we've sort of patched together and that has been successful in the past, but we're of the opinion that in order to continue to grow and build and meet our goal of being a remarkable place for employees to work and physicians to practice, we need to scale those systems up. So I wanted to present a few frameworks for you. One framework, and Case will have some familiarity with this. It's an IHI whole system quality framework, and it's somewhere in between kind of a paint by numbers approach to managing quality that you might find with some programs, to just sort of an IHI best practice, evidence driven. Here's what the other organizations within the IHI community are doing to manage quality at a high level. And Brandy brought this to my attention, and I knew this would appeal to her because there's a part of their definition of quality is includes this definition places quality at the center of the healthcare enterprise. Quality is the organizational strategy, not merely a component of the strategy. So I thought, oh, when Brandy reads that, it's all over with. But it basically provides enough of a framework to build on, but enough flexibility to make it a Jefferson Healthcare program. In addition to that, we have been looking at the Malcolm Baldrige framework for improving quality, and I will speak to that. And we've been looking at what used to be known as the Studer approach to managing patient and patient satisfaction and employee engagement, and that is a toolkit that helps organizations improve the discipline and rigor around managing, I will say, the soft side of the house. Again, relationships between my relationship to the board, my relationship with SLG, SLG's relationship with the directors, and directors' relationship with all their employees, with a heavy, heavy, heavy leadership at training and development component. So some stuff that will take more than 90-second sound bites, and I really want to take enough time with this, and I will get this to you and then it's first part of next week, the binder with reading material, because I'm interested in your thoughts. We're spending a lot of time looking at it, and I'm very interested in the board's thoughts. So those are kind of the two big issues that I wanted to spend some time on. They certainly won't take the entire morning and half of an afternoon. So if there are issues that the board wants to talk about, that would be great. I will say that I'm talking with Karma tomorrow, I think, about scheduling out our typical annual meeting where we get together to just work on the board book and how to sharpen the effectiveness of governance. So we will have another bite out of this apple, but if there are issues that are timely that the board wants to put on this next week's retreat agenda, I'm all for it.
Okay, thank you, Mike. Are there any questions about this? Okay, we're looking forward to that retreat. Then the second part of our governance education is the report from.
Could I ask a question just in terms of process?
Yes.
Ideas for the retreat, do you want those to be sent to you and Mike, to the whole board? If we have some other topic we'd like to put on the retreat, what's the best way for us to communicate that?
The best way would be to send it to Alyssa. And then she would, I could be in contact with her, and then we could, Mari and I could set the agenda based on those.
Okay, thanks. Yeah.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you. Then the second portion of our governance education is a report from Tom Dingus, CPA of Dingus, Zarcor, and Associates, on our recent annual independent audit conducted at the board's request as part of our normal due diligence every year. We begin with a welcome to the representatives of the State Auditor's Office who are joining us today. Thank you for being here, and we appreciate all that you do to on behalf of our community and for Jefferson Healthcare. So thank you. Yeah, I know you're here somewhere in there. And so I now turn the virtual podium over to Tom. Welcome again, Tom. It's nice to see you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Tom Dingus from Dingus Zarcor Associates, and I'm assuming everybody can hear me, just making sure I got the technology's good. All right. So I'm Tom Dingus. I think I know most of you from past years of giving this presentation. And hopefully next year we'll all be in the same room when we do it. That will be our goal. So just a quick introduction. I think most of you know me, but a partner, CPA firm. I have four other partners. There's about 40 people in our firm, and we work exclusively with critical access hospitals, rural hospitals, and other healthcare organizations, and then a little bit of not-for-profit type of work, but all public sector, all healthcare. There'll be three reports I'm going over today, and certainly please ask questions anytime along the way. And now I'm going to share screen, and I think I disappear from the picture, but you'll still hear me and we'll see the screen, which is always probably better anyway. And so can you see my screen? Does it say? Oops, I forgot that. There we go. Let's try that. Now, can you see it? Oh, here we go.
Nope.
Now, can you see it?
Nope. Not yet.
There. Yeah, it shows it.
Bingo.
Okay, it's there now. Okay, good. Alyssa and I practiced yesterday, so I was hoping I didn't mess it up for today. So the first of the reports is the audited financial statements, and I'll just kind of, some of the pages will spend a little more time on, but there'll be a lot of pages we'll go through quickly. But certainly if I'm skipping through a page you have questions about or something you want to ask, please stop me and I will talk about that. So kind of going through here, the first, jump ahead here to these pages. I'm going to get the screen size right here, so it flows a little better here. This is the first of the three audit reports that you're going to have in the financial statements. Oh my goodness. There we go. This is the first of the three auditor's reports. This is where we give our opinion on the financial statements. And it is an unmodified report, which means that the financial statements that follow present fairly the financial position and changes in financial position of the organization. What you'd expect it to say, what you want it to say, and what it does say. So then we'll kind of move down to the next So nothing new and different there. You get to the balance sheet or statements of net position, and a couple key numbers here, and mostly just pointing out what I think the key numbers are and then what some differences from the previous year. And I think you have all this in your packet too. If this isn't big enough, I can actually probably make this a little bigger for the screen. I can see everybody getting closer. The ones of you I can see, I can see are getting closer to the screen. So I'm taking that as a sign it's not very big. Is that cash and cash equivalents? You'll see that number is, you know, almost 27 million compared to 8.2 million in the previous year. Remember though, when we get to the next page, that you have 18 at December 31st, there was $18 million of Medicare advance payments that you'd received that will get repaid back in 21 and 22. So, and I'm just going to kind of mentally subtract 18 million from that number, represents about 53 days of cash on hand. Looks like a really good number. You know, it is a good number. The second thing I always like to point out is the estimated third-party payer settlements. You'll see that the $2,686,000 receivable, that's the estimated receivable for the Medicare cost report of $2,150,000 for 2020, and then a final settlement from 2016 of about $445,000 that's coming through, and then a little bit of Medicaid settlements estimated as well for some prior years. And remembering, as a critical access hospital with a significant amount, I thought I turned off my so that's a little message that still pop up. As a critical access hospital, you're paid cost for your inpatient, outpatient, skilled swing bed, rural health clinic visits, and Medicare estimates an interim rate based on information that's previously been provided, and then you get paid on that estimation. And then at the end of the year, it gets settled. And so some years you have a receivable and some years you have a payable, just to see how the critical access hospital reimbursement system works. And certainly in a year with COVID and changes in volumes and expenses, the settlement numbers we see are generally larger because most places didn't incur less expenses, probably more in response, and volumes in most places decrease. So you think your cost to charge ratios, your utilization to your expenses is down. So your cost per unit went up, and so Medicare will pay more in that case. Seeing a lot of relatively big receivables this year. The grants number, $1.4 million. A lot of that's the FEMA grant that you've applied for and working through that as response to COVID, and some other grants in there as well. So a little different there as well. And then inventories, is another number that's a lot higher, and really kind of two major components there at a high level, both higher levels on hand because of COVID supply chain and just having more on hand in response because of COVID. And then also the fact that drug prices continue to go up, and some of the pharmacy inventory continues to be a bigger and bigger number from year to year. And then you'll also see just a little under $30 million in cash and cash equivalents, restricted or limited assets to use. There's some more information on that on note 4 later in the financial statements. But most of that is money you guys have set aside as the board for future capital improvements and other reserves. Not to use for operations. That's the kind of the big things there. And then you get to the.
Could I ask a question, sir, please?
Sure. Yes.
This is Case. Why are the pharmacy receivables so low compared to the previous year? Maybe you mentioned that, but I must have missed it.
I cannot remember why last year was higher. Generally shouldn't be very high with what's outstanding from the pharmacies or the contract 340B programs. Just a little bit of timing probably when you were getting some payments in the previous year. I honestly don't remember off the top of my head why that changed.
Yeah, Tom, this is Mike. Case, it's not uncommon due to the vacancies of the 340B program that there's like a $250,000 swing from month to month. So kind of depending on when things were closed, that could possibly speak to some of that difference.
Okay, thank you.
That seems like what Mike just said is what we see too. It's like some years there's not very much receivable and other years there's quite a bit. And so that's not too unexpected. And then on the liabilities and net position, the main thing is what I've already talked about here is that the Medicare accelerated payments that will start to get paid back first are getting paid back as of now at 25% of your Medicare remittance advices are getting withheld as part of that repayment. And then eventually it switches to 50%. And then after 29 months from last March or April, they'll either want the payment back or you'll have a 4% interest at that point in time. So it's sort of like a line of credit, interest-free line of credit for 29 months that provided some safety net and stability for cash flow. Long-term debt, no changes in long-term debt. Note 7 later in the financial statements has additional information. There was some new capital lease obligations for equipment incurred during 2020. Not large numbers in relation to the size of your organization, but some new obligations there as well. And then moving on to the income statement. You know, and really interestingly enough, like net patient service revenue is almost exactly, I mean, pretty close to flat between the 2 years, even though you had growth in your organization with COVID impacting volumes, less acute care days, less ICU days, less surgeries, less births, less ER visits, all the reduction of volume in those departments. You know, certainly lab had a little more work to do in COVID. And when it was all said and done, the net patient service revenue was about the same, even though there was some decreases in some of your service lines of how many people you actually served. And then the next line is your pharmacies, both your retail pharmacy and also your contract 340B pharmacy. And then grants you'll also see a little bit up from the previous year and that's not the COVID grants that are there. That's the everything that's not COVID related grants. There's dental grants in there, some other grants from some other organizations for operations that show up there. And then you get down into your operating expenses and you see that salaries are up 13% and overall expenses are up 7% with growth of the organization. Some of that salary increase is right because your emergency room providers were contracted in the previous years and would have shown up as professional fees. You see a decrease here and now that shows up as salaries. And so additional people in the organization. Probably the most important part to take out of this is that your operating loss from decreased by about $9 million. And all the audit presentations have done, this is almost always true, is you get down to the COVID-19 grants and the CARES Act provider relief funds that was provided to healthcare organizations. It shows as non-operating revenue because it's government assistance that subsidizes operations. So it shows up as non-operating by government accounting standards. But you'll see there's a decrease in operating income of about $9 million. And there's an inflow of COVID relief funds of $9.6 million. And while it's not a dollar for dollar exact match, what I've seen in all through the audits we've done since COVID occurred and people have got this relief funds is that the COVID money did what it was supposed to so far, is that it about exactly backfills most organizations, the impact it had on their operating position. So it did what it was intended to do. And then, so then you get down here to your what you consider really your net income is very similar between the two previous years, and that the COVID relief money backfilled what you didn't, the additional expenses incurred and the lost revenue. And we're kind of seeing that play out across the board with all the hospitals we work with. Then the next couple pages are the statement of cash flows. I wasn't going to go through that in any too much detail. Just shows actual inflows and outflows. And you can see, I guess, right here in the middle, the money that came in for provider relief fund and that Medicare accelerated payment to provide that safety net. And then you get to the notes to the financial statements, which start on page 8. And remembering that the notes serve three primary purposes for the organization. The first part is who you are as an organization, how you're organized, who you serve, what your mission is, how you're governed, and where you're located. And then it goes into the second part of how different transactions and balances are recorded and recognized in the financial statements. It's really good reading. Not so much that you wanted to read it to you right now, but it does help you understand the financial statements. And then the third part of the notes are additional, I'm going to skip down here, are additional notes of information that a reader of the financial statements would want to know about your organization. And thinking that an audited financial statement, while it serves a purpose for management and definitely has a key purpose for you as commissioners in your governing role, they're really designed for people and organizations outside of your organization as they make decisions. In your case, as a public hospital district, definitely as citizens, but also your lenders, your bondholders, anybody wants the lease to you, your insurers, all want to know about your financial information. So things that somebody external would want to know. I was just going to hit on the main ones, or changes. And I always, as you can see, if that's telling you, it just hit 100 degrees here. That's crazy. Assets restricted or limited to use. I mentioned this earlier, that about $29 million set aside for capital and other reserves. And then jumping ahead, the notes are relatively the same. So if you have questions, let me know. I'm going to jump ahead quite a bit here and get to long-term debt. I always just like to point out, this note does show your long-term debt obligations, which are for your bonds and no payables, are no different than what they were in the previous years, just the payments that have been made. And there were some capital lease obligations incurred for equipment. And then the second page, the information, but this one, which is very small on the screen, I'm sure, shows your future debt service for the different types of bonds, the limited tax general obligations, and all your other obligations, and what is due each year on your existing debt service. So just information there. And then also the similar thing for the capital lease obligations that were incurred. The other note that I always think is important to spend a couple seconds on is the net patient service revenue, how much comes from Medicare and Medicaid. And about 59% of your net patient service revenue is from Medicare, and another 12% is from Medicaid. That includes the Medicare Advantage within the Medicare, and then also all the Medicaid managed care programs within the Medicaid number. So just around 70% of your net patient service revenue comes from the Medicare and Medicaid programs, which is, which for the hospital services, and in the Medicare case, the rural health clinic, are cost-based. So keeping that in mind. And then your other payers and patient amounts. There is a note later on the CARES Act, which we talked about, that you did, as the district did receive a little over $8.3 million in CARES Act provider relief funding that was recognized as revenue in 2020. And that's the main part of the financial statement. I'll pause there if there's any questions before I kind of get into the couple other auditor's reports, any kind of the numbers part in a sense.
Yes, Tom, has the commercial insurance declined, percentage of commercial insurance?
As a percentage, it did. Last year, your Medicare and Medicaid were approximately 69% of the total net patient service revenue, and this year they're approximately 71%. So, I don't know, it declined some. I wouldn't say that's substantial or significant, but it changed a little bit in that regard. Yeah.
Thank you.
It is less.
Would you mind going back to the page that showed the bond information over the next, I forget, I didn't see how many years out that went.
It shows the first 5 years, next 5 years individually, and then it shows the increments of five after that. I'll try to make it, that's like a small font, even in.
And I'm curious as to your thoughts of the I know that there's a limit, a recommended limit to how much one can leverage assets for bonding purposes. Do you have any comments as to where we are at this point in terms of our bond load or long-term debt load?
You don't really, I mean, some districts will use unlimited tax general obligation bonds to fund capital projects. That's what, and you have had those in the past with the voter approved levies to pay. You don't have any of those now. Limited tax general obligation bonds are secured by your maintenance operation tax, the kind of the tax revenue you get year to year. And I was just looking at that, which is around $500,000 a year. And that's why that's kind of limited, is that limited tax general obligation bond is about what is serviced by your maintenance operation levy. And the rest of your debt is paid back from essentially revenue or operations. And there's a debt to equity ratio later we have, and I think if I remember right, it's get to that later, but I think it was 30% and around 30%. Ultimately, I don't know if I really have a rule of thumb other than you have to do the financial feasibility study to show that whatever the project is can be repaid with your projected operating revenue. And certainly any lenders are going to want to see that, whether you do that through USDA or any other bond authority or just even a commercial lender. They'll want to see that organization has the ability to repay. And I know you've done that in the past with the USDA project, where it had to have a financial feasibility study done or projection to show that the organization had the ability to repay. Hey, off the top, I haven't done a feasibility study. I don't want to really venture to give a definitive answer, but you have positive net income and positive operating results, you know, COVID notwithstanding, is that yes, you have more capacity. What exactly that is, I don't know without an analysis.
Okay. Yeah. And then if I might, there was a question I had about the page that showed the bad debt projections or the bad debt, and it looked like there was considerably less bad debt expected. Provision for bad debt is more than $1 million less than 2019. And I'm wondering
if some of that was,
I'm just wondering if there's an explanation for that.
Some of that has to do with you had less self-pay patients, and some of it was your approach to how you were collecting that too, and more of it was written off without collection as part of your approach that you took this year. Some of that is just less patient service revenue or less self-pay revenue or self-pay to collect this year, so there was less chance of there being bad debt as well, but also part of your philosophy of what you were trying to collect.
That's another question that deserves a lengthy answer. And actually, Tyler is targeting September to give a review over all of our revenue adjustments, contractual allowances. That there are we have made little tweaks that resulted in big confusing changes in how things were tracking and major decisions that we're not exactly sure how that impacted how things were tracking. So Tyler has been trying to get to the bottom of that and is going to present to the board kind of a big picture. Here's why we think there's been such a swing in our contractual allowances over the last 5 to 6 months, with a particular interest in bad debt charity care and the effect of some of our collections policy decisions is or is not having on the hospital. So that's coming up in September.
Great. And I wonder if we need to carve out more than the usual amount of time for that, maybe as part of the educational session or something of that sort. So I'd like to just pose that possibility to Mari and Jill when they plan the agenda.
Okay.
Yes. All right. Well, duly noted.
All right. Moving into the last part of the audited financial statements is on page 25. It's the second of the three auditor's reports that you have. This is where we report on internal controls over financial reporting and compliance in accordance with government auditing standards required because, first of all, because you're a public hospital district, a governmental entity in the state of Washington, but also this year, also because you do have federal funding over $750,000, which kicked in the requirements for a single audit or audit in accordance with uniform guidance. So it would have been required for that regard either. The main takeaway of this report, this is where there would be material weaknesses or significant deficiencies, audit findings reported if there were any. And there are no material weaknesses or significant deficiencies reported. So that's the important takeaway of this. It's good. And that's good. You know, you had changeover and, you know, finance people and from the last audit. And so that's, you know, if there was a lot of, you know, change over there. And so it's a good accomplishment that changeover occurred and we didn't have to come back with a finding. So that's good that it all handled, got to where we're at today in a good place. The last of the three auditors' reports.
So that was Tom's way of complimenting Sasha and Michael and Ray and the finance and accounting team and led by Tyler. So great job, group.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you, everyone.
Yeah. After, you know, from our perspective, for quite a few years working with pretty much the same team for quite a few years, and then switching to having both Tyler and Sasha coming in the process, and so, you know, new people, and it all worked out. It's fun to work with Tyler and Sasha as well, and I think we're all in a good place now too, as we're going forward on everything, ever getting back up to speed with everything too. So that's good. Then the last of the audit reports. Like I said, this is our report just on the federal funds that were considered a major program, which is the FEMA grant that you've applied for and are getting reimbursed for. And the main there's no findings result from this. This narrows down to just on the FEMA expenditures themselves that we tested. So this is like a very relatively narrow in scope compared to the rest of the audit, or just the federal fund. And for the single audit is going to become a regular thing for your district, because this year it was the FEMA funds. Next year it will be the CARES Act Provider Relief Funds after you report to DHHS in the next couple months on the $8.3 million. We'll need to audit that next year as part of the single audit. But also your the rules have changed for those outstanding USDA loans or bonds, secured bonds you have. Will require us to do a single audit on that. It'll be a pretty straightforward and simple single audit, but you will see these single audit reports for the foreseeable future. And there's always going to be a reason you're going to have a single audit, I think, you know, going forward for the next several years. So just because you've had a single audit in the past, and it's kind of, you've had it for a year or two, and then it goes away, and then it comes back. I think now you're going to have it for a while. Moral of that story. And then the rest of the pages, more information required because of the single audit. It's a summary of audit results. I've already went through that, but that's the page you can kind of really go to, page 29, that summarizes if there were findings. It tell you what they were and what was audited and the like, and what types of audit reports were issued, which I've covered. And then there was no findings in the past. And then the last schedule is the actual schedule of federal expenditures, which lists out all the federal funding that was received in 2020. It doesn't include the CARES Act money. The CARES Act money is a whole different beast, and how that, because you haven't reported yet to DHHS, there's essentially nothing to audit until you report. I like to say you can't be wrong until you do something. That's how I kind of like to say, it's like you haven't been required to report it until just the last month, and over the next couple of months. And so we'll audit that reporting of the CARES Act money to the federal government. So that will fall in the next audit period, even though it was received in 2020 and recognized as revenue in 2020, the auditing will occur in 2021. So just keeping that in mind. So that's the audit of financial statements. The next report that we usually go through are the financial indicators, and we present these as a byproduct of the audit to help show kind of visually what the numbers mean in relation to the size of your organization. You can look at the amount of cash you have, but what does it mean to your operations? And then there's also some comparisons to prior years of your historical results, and then also to benchmarks from national databases that are lagging a bit. And then you've also asked to compare to some like-sized hospitals that we work with. And I'll kind of jump to the next page here. There's three or four ratios where we have comparative hospitals from kind of our database of hospitals we work with. And I would say this is both, it has usefulness, but it's always difficult too, because every hospital has its own story. And so why are they different than you is not always as like simple as me just giving you a couple sentence explanation. And so there's a lot of reasons. And so that, you know, every ratio has a story, every hospital has its own story. And then you throw in the fact that 2020 obviously was, you know, the COVID pandemic, and nobody's operations were exactly normal, or not even remotely normal in 2020. And so that makes the numbers a little more variable as well. The common theme of the group of hospitals we picked are that they are all larger critical access hospitals that provide a more full range of services like you do. We didn't pick the smaller ones to put in there that were more limited in their services. So even though the net patient service revenue, kind of, you are actually the largest one on the list, because I haven't actually done this in a while, but I don't know if you guys know, but you got to be one of the larger critical access hospitals on the net patient service revenue in the whole entire United States, actually. I mean, I was thinking you've jumped ahead a couple of these other ones that I think were bigger than you at times in the past. And so the other commonality, you see the states, I think another important commonality, these states that are listed, they're all states that expanded Medicaid too. And I don't have it. There is actually one non-critical access hospital included in here, because it's a really large, like, non-critical access hospital. It's a small non-critical access hospital. It's like the other end of the scale, and just for kind of its relative size to put in here. So that's the commonalities of these. And I think, like you guys, most larger critical access hospitals do pretty well. Sometimes you do a little better, sometimes it's not as good, but generally speaking, the larger critical access hospitals in states that have expanded Medicaid are financially solid. Year to year, they jump around. So amongst a lot of talk there before I got into the actual numbers. But so total margin, what's your total revenue compared to your net income compared to your total revenue? Margin of 2.5%. You can see that decreased a little bit from the prior year. Last year, you did actually have a large, like, one-time capital dental grant that helped boost it up a little bit there too. You can see pretty much right kind of around the medians with those comparisons there. Generally speaking, being in the 3-6% range is a goal to be in. The next one shows it to just the comparison hospitals with you guys over here to the left, and you can see kind of all over the place. And like I said, every hospital has its own story. I mean, why that one's so large and the differences, comparisons, but all positive. Operating margin, with COVID, kind of a common theme a lot, because the provider relief fund is shown as non-operating, operating margins did decrease for almost all hospitals in 2020, as yours did. And then you see, you can see how these also decrease compared to their total margins, what their operating margins are much smaller and more negative. And Hospital G in here, I almost think I should take them out because they get an incredible amount of tax revenue. I mean, it's good to have oil in your backyard kind of place. could be a place that and tax all that. And so they're a little outlier there. And then days cash on hand. You can see the big jump up. And remember, about 52 days of that cash is that $18 million of Medicare accelerated payments. So kind of subtract that back out there. You're 113 days, which is still up from your previous year, you know, still a positive trend upward. And then you can see, you know, kind of right above most of the medians there as well. And generally speaking, 90 days is a good operating reserve. And then after that, you're building capital reserves and you're on that path. And then this is, you know, with the comparison hospitals, you're, interestingly, you're more than quite a few of them. And you can see, you know, Hospital F, which I can't remember who they are, but they have, that's a lot of cash on hand. It's more than a day's, a year's worth. But you can see all solidly above 120 and getting into that 180 range the most.
Hey, Tom, a note for the board. The good news is our cash position is even taking into account the Medicare prepaid. It's at a really strong place now, and I that's largely a function of 2020 when business slowed and the governor's proclamation and our community's appropriate caution about coming back to the hospital for a while, that we really went into a cash preservation mode. Until those CARES checks came in, we were a little worried about having to run off of excess cash. So the good news is CARES cash came in and our cash position is strong now. However, we deferred some capital equipment purchases and other uses of cash that we normally, if we, you know, looked out and saw 90 to 120 days of stable operations, we normally would have released. So I anticipate probably a bigger than normal capital budget in 2022. And fewer discretionary items. So that's a long way of saying I think our cash bite in capital items will probably be greater next year than certainly than in this year and the year before.
Going on to the next ratio is the current ratio of your current assets compared to your current liabilities, your ability to meet your obligations as they come due. You see that still above 2, which is what it needs to be. Remember, you have that $18 million in there as that liability and the cash, and so it kind of skews that out a little bit, but still solidly okay, in good spot. Capital expenditures, actually a little bit of what Mike was just saying, shows when the percentage is above 100%, it means you've purchased more equipment than you had depreciation on equipment, which would roughly equate to you're replacing your equipment at the same rate you're using it up. And you can see, you know, any year is going to be a little different as significant pieces of equipment might bump that up or down a little bit. But you can see in 2020, it was actually less than 100%, which you're not looking at any year when you're necessarily individually, but that does see a little bit of a trend that could indicate that you have some capital to purchase in a subsequent year. Long-term debt to capitalization, the amount of debt to equity, you know, certainly, you know, edged down just a little bit as you paid debt payments and had a positive net income that increased your debt position. So not a particular, there's really no right or wrong answer to this. It's all stages you're in of for capital projects and stuff. So we're there. Net days and net patient accounts receivable, the average time to collect, very stable from the years. That's probably really the first thing you want to look at, is that making sure you're not jumping all around in your cash collections and revenue cycle effectiveness. that's pretty, I'd say those are right in the kind of the range of where you want to be as good. We'll see a few that are a little less, but most are actually higher. So in a relative good place there. This just shows it a different way without allowances and contractual adjustments. Again, still the same trend and good indicators, strong indicators. Contractual adjustment percentage. I think this is kind of fascinating in just how consistent what you don't collect from Medicare, Medicaid, and commercial insurers is year to year. I mean, it's almost statistically impossible that it would be that exactly consistent through the years, but right around 52% of your charges are not paid by Medicare, Medicaid, and commercial insurers. And different hospitals kind of run at a different percentage. So it's more about the change from year to year, which you have no change is what you're monitoring here. Bad debt as a percentage of net patient service revenue. As was pointed out earlier, decreased a little bit this year. Last year was though a little higher than what it had been before too. So for as far as trends, generally lower than some of the peer hospitals. With a significant amount of Medicare and Medicaid in your community and some commercial insurers, there's not a lot of, and in a state that's expanded Medicaid, there's not a lot of self-pay left to potentially be bad debt. I mean, there are obviously some, but there's less and less. And then bad debt and charity care percentages, pretty similar between years, relatively no numbers. That's as a percent of gross revenue. Thinking bad debt is theoretically patients that have the ability to pay and don't pay, and charity care are patients that don't have the ability to pay. Full-time equivalents, the number of people that work in your organization. This is the full-time equivalents. I think earlier I heard, when I jumped on, I was waiting, I think I heard Mike say like 900 employees, not all full-time. The full-time equivalents is 703. So some increase there just shows because it is your largest expense. You are a people business service. This shows the salaries and benefits per each FTE on average. This includes everybody in your system, and you do employ a lot of physicians and other providers and technicians and nurses and housekeepers and maintenance and a whole array of people. But this is the average cost and benefits for each person, and fairly consistent through the years. This is, we included this one, but I was a little leery to include this one because this is even when I say every story, hospital has a story, this is even more so every hospital has a story of why their average salaries and benefits per FTE are different. I couldn't tell you why A and D are low. But you can see it's relatively consistent as the state type of service hospitals that will have employed providers, will have the full array of service with technicians and nurses and the like. And so fairly similar. Net patient service revenue per FTE, you see that did decrease. It's a broad measure of productivity, and that makes sense in a year where you had responses to COVID that required people and you were still growing as an organization, but because of COVID, less people sought or were seeking services. This shows that comparison to others as well. The more I look at this, the more I question the FTE numbers that we're using for A and D. So I think the other ones are more comparative. And you can see kind of all over the place a bit. And remembering these FTE numbers that we include in these are employed FTEs. And some, you're always going to have a fair amount of contracted personnel as well that aren't in this number. And so that can ebb and flow it a bit as well. And that was it. Any questions on that? I'm going to go ahead and actually stop share. I could talk about the last letter without you seeing it. I think the share. So, and I'll just real quickly on the last letter. This is a kind of a laundry list of things you'd want to know as a board from your auditor. And the bottom line is there's nothing that's a red flag or anything in here. The first part of significance, it does point out there's estimates and financial statements. It points out what those are. The one thing, there was no difficulties in performing the audit. There were no material misstatements that were proposed as a result of the audit procedures. That's an important note from the audit, is that if your auditors are coming in and making material adjustments, that gives you less assurance that what you're getting on a regular basis is as accurate as you would want it to be as a board and rest of the management team. So that's there's none of that going on, that we didn't make any material audit adjustments. This year, we also pointed out that technically, the Jefferson Healthcare Foundation and the Hospice Foundation of Jefferson Healthcare are technically component units of the district because they are set up to support the hospital, and they're not included in the scope of the audit, but they're insignificant to the overall operation, so they are excluded. That's very typical with foundations, is they're not, some include them in the scope and some don't, but just to point out that technically they are required to be, technically they should be, but they're not material, so that anything that's not material doesn't have to be included, so kind of adding that to the mix this year. That is my audit report, and certainly any questions on anything you would have for me?
Case, you have a question?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Tom. Great summary report. Would you say a little bit more about your final statements there about the foundations? Although it's not material, meaning that the quantity is small, is there any need or any benefit to the board of having some kind of report about that relationship, or what is your advice to the board?
That's a great question. And what we see in practice is we will audit hospitals that will include really insignificant foundations in the scope on the theory that they want that adds that level of accountability to the foundation. And then we have others that include even much bigger in relation to your organization that are still not material excluded. So there's different philosophies. I guess the reason you would want to is it is technically a component unit of the district. And so depending on your, and I can't remember specifically how your level of control is, or if you're just beneficiaries off the top of my head, but it can add a level of accountability. Some difficulty is a lot of times the foundations, while technically a component unit of the hospital, the people that run them and the accounting is very separate from the hospital, and so coordinating that into the audit, if even though technically they are part of your reporting entity, they may not feel they're part of your reporting entity. That's the way to put that. And that should add a level of complexity. It might not be worth the effort. But it is something, I honestly think it's something to think about. And when we started including this in here, it was kind of like, it does serve that element of like asking the question you're asking is to make a kind of a conscious, I mean, not that you've made an unconscious decision, but actually to maybe more formally make a decision of whether they should be in your scope or not in your scope of your audit. And thinking about how they really relate to you and how their accountability works. Kind of a long-winded answer to it depends, but I think it's worth thinking about.
that's very helpful, and I do think that conversation would be worth having, so that at least in the records we've made a conscious decision one way or the other.
I'll provide Tyler the analysis we did on each of the foundations, and you know exactly where we got to where we're at, so he has that for future conversations you might have, and I'm going to write that down right now or I'll forget.
Actually, that leads to, so you actually have audited their accounts, but it's just not part of the report to the board, is that the way I'm understanding it?
No, we haven't audited it. What we have done is we've looked at the bylaws and the articles of incorporation to determine if they are, sh- should be considered a component unit. So we have that analysis of
how
we came to that conclusion.
Okay.
And we also do request their financial statements. They're not audited, but we do get their financial statements to make sure that we're comfortable that they are immaterial to your overall operations or insignificant to your overall operations.
Right, and maybe I could ask Mike, are those statements audited? Are those foundations, do they have their own audit process?
I don't know.
They do have 990s filed each year for them because they are not for profit. Somebody is preparing. I think you have a local CPA that's preparing the IRS Form 990s for those organizations. So there is at least some bodies looking at the numbers. That's not an audit, but
the reporting goes on. The answer to the question of is there an annual audit is what I don't have an answer for. Yeah.
We can look into that at another time.
That would be great. Thank you.
Tom, thank you for your report. Excellent. Good news.
Thank you.
Sounds all around. And thank you to all of the people involved in that for such a great report. Are there any other questions or comments from the board? All right.
Well, another thank you to all the people working for Tyler.
Yeah. And Bruce, did you have a
question? Yeah, I would just second what Case just said, but also it's nice to have a nice clean audit without any exceptions. So it's good. Good work.
Yeah.
Yeah, just my final comments. I agree. Tyler and his team did a fantastic job in a year of transition. So I appreciate that. While they're the tip of the iceberg, it represents lots of leaders and directors doing the right things the right way in managing district resources. So I appreciate that. And lastly, I just have to make the comment that you look at Tom's report and he makes 2020 look so normal and just like any other year. And such an upside down, topsy turvy, crazy year the audit report is just real boring. And I guess that's $9 million from CARES does that for you. But thanks. Yeah. Thanks again for Tom. Another great audit. We appreciate your work very much.
Thank you, Tom. And I hope to see you next year. This time you don't have a long drive home. So you'll appreciate that. And I hope to see you next year. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Tom, again, and we'll see you soon.
Okay.
At this time, we will go ahead and recess until 3:30, and when we will come back and have our business portion of the meeting. Thank you, everybody. See you soon. Hey, welcome back to the business portion of the July 28th Jefferson County Public Hospital District Number 2 Board of Commissioners meeting. The first item we begin with is one of our favorite roles, that of recognizing the Jefferson Healthcare team, employee, and provider of the quarter. Each person recognized today has gone above and beyond in their own roles to provide outstanding service to our patients and our community. We thank you, each one, for your dedication and your excellent work. And Mike, do you want to begin? Or Caitlin? Mike, you want to introduce Caitlin? And Caitlin can introduce our people.
You bet. I think most of you have met Caitlin Harrison. Caitlin is our Chief Human Resources Officer. And she is going to be on point for announcing and celebrating our employees. Take it away, Kate.
It's my favorite part of the job, so Mike's very gracious in letting me get a chance to do this every quarter. So I'm excited to see that we have our folks mostly on the line. I can see a few photos. So we're going to start with Jeremiah Fountain. Jeremiah, do you mind waving for everybody? So Jeremiah received 10 nominations. That is the most we have ever seen come through for one individual. Jeremiah is our employee of the quarter. He's our imaging tech lead in DI, and I'm going to read just one quote about him. Jeremiah is passionate about the department and keeps everyone positive and upbeat. He communicates with all staff members of radiology, as well as physicians and nurses, with the same level of respect and positivity. He speaks to patients and staff alike with a gentleness and a humor that consistently meets the target. I have to say, I think humor and gentleness is a great combination. He's always willing to help if you have a problem. We are all very proud of him and think he deserves recognition. So congratulations to Jeremiah.
Thank you.
Up next is Kevin Hines. He is our provider of the quarter. And I don't, I'm going to do a quick look. I don't see him on, but I'm going to, I will not make him wave. But Kevin has consistently worked closely with our surgeons, office staff, and hospital team to ensure our patients get excellent medical care. His respect for the role his coworkers play in the patient process is clear every day. His attitude in the office is always positive, consistent, professional, and his focus centers on the patient. Plain and simple, Kevin Hines is not only an excellent PA, he's a good man, and Jefferson Healthcare is lucky to have him. I will also add that he has stepped up and been amazing helping us out in our sleep clinic. And we are very appreciative of Kevin. Up next, outside.
And I can attest to Kevin's skill and thoroughness.
So up next, looks like standing in the actual cafe are a few members of our dietary team, which is our team of the quarter. Can we get some waves? There they are. talk about the unsung heroes of our organization, and quite frankly, faces many of us see, some of us multiple times a day. So I'm going to go ahead and read their names. It's Jennifer Brown, Nicholas Collier. I'm going to stick with first names. Ananda, Michael, Chris, Kimberly, Tina, Chanda, Sherry, Daniel, Steve, Marianne, Cynthia, Michelle, Mary, Jimmy, Eileen, Kimberly, Caleb, and of course our leaders, Bobby Dean and Aaron Stark. This team is phenomenal. They go above and beyond to meet the special requests of our patients and their families. Always friendly and helpful, they work with the clinical team to keep everyone well fed and happy. They often bring late requests for food and beverages to the ICU and ACU floor themselves, eager to help during our busiest times. They set a high standard for professionalism and are courteous at all times. So congratulations to our dietary staff. So we have a brand new addition to our recognition. And our very first ever leader of the quarter is Jamie Hubler. So Jamie, do you mind giving a wave, masked up? So Jamie is our RN clinical manager for the medical group. And I will also say she wears about 9 other hats. She's helped run the res clinic, the vaccines, testing. She's also our partner in recruiting for RNs as well as MAs. So she sort of does it all. Jamie's ability to provide our community with COVID services was an exceptional team effort, and Jamie was the glue that successfully bound the teams. She coordinated processes across departments, she still does, and is a trusted clinical partner to our COVID physician leaders. She was the ultimate ambassador for the COVID work. Through these challenges, her professionalism has never wavered. We successfully continue to serve our community because of her leadership and dedication. Congratulations, Jamie. Thank you.
Thank you, Caitlin, and thank you, Jeremiah, Kevin, Jamie, and Dietary. And I must say, Dietary has a well-deserved recognition throughout the entire community.
Yes.
So thank you. Congratulations again to all of you, and thank you for jobs well done. Okay, then we will go on now to the more mundane things, such as the minutes. So is there a motion to approve the minutes of June 15th, June 17th, and June 20th?
So move.
Second.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded. Is there discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. I see everybody's in agreement, so the motion carries. Required approvals, is there anything that anybody would like to take out and discuss separately? May I have a motion then to approve the required approvals?
So move.
Is there a second?
Second.
Okay. Discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Okay.
Aye.
Opposed? Hearing none, required approvals is approved. Sounds like somebody's mic is on and it's causing some feedback on the. There, that's much better. Thank you. So we will go on now with the compliance report. This is our annual report by our attorney, John French. John, want to take it away? Please.
Sure. Thank you, Commissioner Bueller. Hello, everyone. Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Looks like we have the report up. Can everyone see it? All right. I will request control here, and we will go ahead. And Alyssa, am I able to advance the slides myself?
You should be now.
Great. Thank you. So it's been a while since we talked about compliance, and I wanted to make sure that we go through this in a little bit of detail. I'm not actually able to do it, Alyssa. It doesn't look like it'll
move.
You
go down there.
There we go. Okay. Here's a brief agenda of what I'd like to go through today, and then we'll have some time for some questions. But we want to do a quick review of the structure and the goals of the program. Just a little bit of a status update on how we're doing and some key risk areas and opportunities that I've identified that I think you should know about. And then some additional initiatives that we'll discuss as well. So here's your seven elements of the effective compliance program in a healthcare setting that is promulgated by the Office of the Inspector General. And we'll walk through this report in terms of how we meet each of those seven elements, that will be the framework of our conversation. These are the key compliance laws and policies that we're discussing. Even among compliance professionals, there's some disagreement and sometimes misunderstanding on what the program should actually cover, how it overlaps with the quality function that Brandy manages, and who does what. But this is what we have come up with as what belongs in our compliance and integrity program at Jefferson Healthcare. And the guidelines that OIG puts out are very clear that you can design your program to fit the type of organization you are, the size of organization you are, whether you're rural, whether you're urban, whether you're big or small, or part of a larger system. And these are all areas that you see here that we cover in our program. It starts with our code of conduct. It sets the tone for our ethical behavior here. And then the specific areas that we look at are conflicts of interest, HIPAA and privacy, EMTALA, and then the broader fraud, waste, and abuse in healthcare payments, which really includes anti-kickback and STARK, and then false claims. And then making sure that we have a system here that people are aware of to be able to report when they see something that doesn't seem right and know that they will be protected from reprisals. So it's a combination of law and policy, and I'll walk through each of those. Here's just-
Could you remind me what EMTALA is?
EMTALA is the Emergency Medical and Active Labor Treatment Act. I said those probably a little bit out of order, but it's also known as the Patient Anti-Dumping Statute. And it requires hospitals with dedicated emergency departments to do certain things when someone presents to the emergency department for treatment of an emergency medical condition. So, for example, you can't send somebody away without doing a medical screening exam and stabilizing them for for transfer, and transfer can only be to a higher level of care. Those are some of the key things that you see in EPTAL. This policy is the overarching compliance and integrity program policy. It's only the first page of it, but it says how we at Jefferson Healthcare will comply with each of those elements. And then it's pretty comprehensive. If you go to the last page, which again is shown here in policy stat, it links all of our compliance policies in one place. So it's really easy for people to find it. So starting with the OIG requirements, again, for an effective compliance program, I just wanted to tell you how ours is structured to comply. Our program has standards, policies, and procedures. I just showed you the main policy and the attached policies work together with that, but it all comes back to that code of conduct. A violation of any of our compliance policies is also a violation of the code of conduct, and we investigate that like we would any other potential misconduct in the organization, usually through an HR process. A couple of new internal policies that are in development you should know about. We don't have a single comprehensive fraud, waste, and abuse policy, as it's such an important area of emphasis for the OIG. We really do want to have a comprehensive policy. The good news is all of the elements of what you would see there are in other policies. Obviously, we have policies that say don't defraud Medicare, use internal resources properly, don't abuse government programs, et cetera. But we want to have something that's a little bit more tidy and accessible in one place. So we're working on that. And then we need to do annual compliance risk assessments, which we do. But it's good practice to have a policy that says how we put together a compliance risk assessment and what goes into that thought process, and we don't. So the compliance committee is working on that. We review our policies annually, and we update them as needed, particularly as laws change, but we can update them as the needs of our organization change as well. One thing we are doing, right now we are between privacy officers, as you know. I am the interim privacy officer, so the function is being managed and monitored, but it's a good opportunity, partly for my own education, but partly for the organization, to take a look at all of our HIPAA privacy policies. And I have a table in my office that has about 15 of them that probably can be consolidated and simplified into a privacy manual of some sorts. But they've also, some of them have not been updated in 7 or 8 years. So it is time for a comprehensive review, and we're working on that. We will talk about this in the next slide too, but the compliance program has to have leaders and resources in place. The compliance committee has seen a lot of attrition in the last year, mostly because of retirements and other very important duties within the organization. And I've already asked several of the people you see on this list to be involved. They have said yes. The director of Revenue Cycle Integrity, Joe Huang, is joining the committee soon. Dr. Lemke is going to join. She's very effective on our utilization review committee, and we need doers on the compliance committee. And she graciously said yes, even though she has lots of other important things going on. But as you know, we are going to be getting a new information security director, actually information technology director, who will also be doing oversight of clinical informatics. And that person is typically the one we appoint as our information security officer. So I expect that will be the same. We're going to be hiring a new privacy officer and HIM supervisor. Those functions should be represented. And Lori Tinker has retired. So we need to fill her very big shoes on our committee from a nursing perspective, as well as having some direct participation by HR, which is always super helpful in our functions on compliance. But I think it's very valuable to have an actual person sitting on the committee, which would be great. And Caitlin has said yes, so we will find the right person to do that. And then Amy Yaley, I haven't talked to Mike about this, but I think it would be great to have Amy Yaley's expertise on the committee, and she's willing to do that as long as Mike is okay to spare her. You see here our compliance charter. The yellow names are all people who have either left or are about to leave the compliance committee. So it's not enough to just put me and Rena on it, which is why you saw the last slide with new faces joining. But I think it's going to be very effective with those new people, and I'm excited about that. Third element is screening and evaluation of personnel. The good news is we screen 100% of our new hires against OIG exclusion lists. These are lists that say who is not allowed to participate in government programs because of past misconduct, et cetera. We screen everybody on hire. We screen all patient-facing personnel annually. And the best practice is we should be doing it for all employees. I've inquired with HR in the past about whether that's feasible. How feasible and easy would it be? How much of a burden? And we think there's a way to do it where it's not burdensome to the team. So we're going to be able to do that for all employees starting after the first of the year. And then communication, education, and training. The program isn't any good if people don't know what the rules are. We've had no live compliance training sessions in 2021 because it's hard to get groups together. I'd like to do at least a couple per quarter. That was the pace we were on before COVID. But we did update a video presentation that's comprehensive for the whole compliance program and all of those laws and policies that you saw a couple of slides ago. I just updated my presentation via video. So that's available on our compliance website, and all new hires see that. We're going to have everybody also review that annually as part of our safety modules. Everybody who gets hired has to see that. We are at 100% compliance on that. 100% of our new hires also complete a couple of safety modules. We call them safety modules, but really they're just our online training modules that are specifically related to compliance within their first 90 days. So that's good. I don't have a number of all the staff who completed the annual compliance training refresher by October 31st last year. Brandy is out, and she would be the person to give me that number. So I will get that number for you by the next meeting. But I know that Brandy would let me know if there was any concern on that number, and she hasn't. So we're in good shape there. Then we move on to monitoring, auditing, reporting. You get what you measure, right? And it's only good if you actually go look and make sure that the compliance program is working. These are some key numbers. We have no investigations or reports of misconduct involving senior key staff. That's a good sign. We have only one pending investigation that the compliance function is aware of involving federal or state agencies that you are already aware of. That's from our data breach incident last November. The Office for Civil Rights, which is a function of OIG and HHS, is still investigating that, but we don't expect any significant findings or enforcement action from that. So I will let you know as soon as that is resolved. We don't have any new investigations. And one thing I did want to bring to your attention, the internal audit function is really important to the compliance program. And we have a very experienced internal auditor who's certified and trained. That's Laura Showers. And she has been understandably focused on her infection prevention mission, which I think is paramount in importance during a global pandemic. So it may be that we look outside for some resources temporarily to make sure that some of the compliance specific audits that we were doing before can be brought back to life in the interim, because I don't think her infection prevention role is going to diminish anytime soon. And as you said, or as I said, it's really important to all of us. We want to make sure that the internal audit team starts meeting again, too. And I usually sit on that, but there haven't been any meetings. So we need to get together. We need to make sure we have a comprehensive internal audit plan. The good news is the functions are working. I'm not concerned that we're missing misconduct or opportunities to improve. Revenue cycle is working well. Our reporting systems are in place, and we're still getting reports from people who see things that should be investigated. I review things like ethics concerns, conflict of interest concerns that come in, as well as all physician compensation arrangements. I review all physician and provider contracts. So I'm not concerned that these things aren't happening, but our dedicated internal audit function may need some additional resources. So we're working on that. And then We normally have an independent outside hotline for people to make anonymous reports when they have compliance concerns that they observe. And that hotline, we found the vendor was not doing a good job of upholding their end of the bargain, so I fired them. I need to find a new one that helps us do a better job of getting the word out about that hotline. For 3 years, 3.5 years of using this particular vendor, I only saw 2 reports ever come through that hotline. And part of that is we could do a better job of publicizing that, but they really ought to be helping us do that and integrating with our system a little bit better. So we're going to find a new resource on that. More to come. And then the last two are really tied together. HR manages our employee discipline and enforcement processes from a compliance perspective. So if anything violates one of our compliance policies, typically HR is going to get involved at some point if it becomes a matter of some seriousness. So we've had 5 compliance-related investigations related to non-compliance by our personnel this year. All of them happen to implicate HIPAA, so patient privacy concerns. And we found a couple that were substantiated. One had no violation, in our opinion. One employee opted to resign prior to completion of the investigation, so we were not able to actually complete that investigation. But the employee did resign because this employee did not want to cooperate with that. And then we have one that's pending. So corrective actions. A violation of any of these policies can lead to discipline up to and including termination. One person was let go because this was not their first offense related to HIPAA, and we take this very seriously. One was given a verbal warning. It's an opportunity for education, and we always want to start at the lowest level of corrective action possible if we can. So we are working on that. The fact is, you're going to have HIPAA concerns if you have people involved in, touching patient information. Every organization deals with it. Ours are minimal. They tend to be minor, and we focus on re-education wherever possible. The key risk areas, we've already really talked about many of these, but it has been mentioned, Tom Dingus mentioned it, that a risk area is when you turn over most of your leadership in finance and revenue cycle integrity. I think one of the ways we have mitigated that is we've hired really good new people who are well aware of the challenge of coming in and taking this over. We don't have any concerns that there were any violations or problems in those areas before. In all the years that Hillary was here, we never had significant concerns in that area. So we're not concerned, but we do recognize that when you have turnover, that's a risk. Tyler and I have talked about whether it makes sense to do an external audit of the functions themselves, not just the financial statements, which you just saw Tom Dingus present. The good news is financial statements are part of that. Federal awards are part of integrity in dealing with government programs. And we just got a pass with flying colors from our external auditor in that area. But we also want to look at the processes that we have in place for revenue cycle, the controls that we have in place. And now's a good time to establish a baseline with some new leadership. But that's their decision whether or not to do that. As you know, we don't have a full-time privacy officer right now, and I am acting in that capacity on the interim. I'm sure that my skills aren't as good as Melody's, but they're getting better day by day. And it's actually a really great opportunity for me to learn all of the areas that she had to deal with. And I think it will help me to be more helpful in the process of hiring the next person, asking good questions. So I think we're in good shape there temporarily, but we are definitely looking to fill that permanently. And then we mentioned internal audit, and cybersecurity continues to be a big problem for all healthcare organizations. from our perspective in compliance, I'd like to reinforce some basic security steps that we can do around here. If I walk up and down the hall, I always encourage people to lock their computers when they get up and walk away, even for a moment. And so simple things like that can, I think, make a big difference. And let's do the things that we can do to make it harder for bad people to mess with our systems. So we're going to be looking at that in the next year in terms of training and audits. And then the OCR investigation emphasizes how easy it is for bad actors to trick good people. And in some cases, it doesn't even appear that, this particular one was an email where if you touched any portion of the white space on your screen, it triggered whatever malicious code was able to infiltrate our system. So this person wasn't necessarily clicking on something that you would traditionally think, gosh, what were you clicking on that for? What were you thinking? And it was still able to infiltrate our system. So the bad guys are getting more sophisticated. And in the wake of any federal or state investigation like this, even though we don't expect any significant findings or enforcement action, we're going to want to audit that area to show that we are responding to whatever recommendations they make and that we are taking proactive steps to ensure it doesn't happen. And we're already doing training in that area. We've stepped up our internal phishing attempts to make sure we can educate as many employees as possible about how easy it is to fall for this. So more to come on that. And then additional compliance initiatives. We do have an external risk assessment due. So I'm working on finding the right vendor to do that for us. This is something they recommend that we do on a triannual basis. It hasn't been done since I've been compliance officer and would have been done last year were it not for COVID, but now's the time. And then we talked about you get what you measure. I'd like to do a simple DIY, a culture of compliance survey in-house later this year to test people's knowledge about the program. And just get an overall sense of what people think about our ethical culture here. And then we'll use that in planning our programming for next year. Part of that will be our compliance work plan, which we always develop based on what we think are the biggest external and internal threats. Some of those are identified for us by our friends at OIG. They do a work plan as well, and we take that very seriously. It's something we should consider for our organization. But you can guess some of the emphasis areas based on what we've talked about here. We need more live training as that becomes more possible and feasible. Cybersecurity, telehealth is going to be a big one next year because the rules have changed dramatically and the uptake and use of telehealth has become very strong over the last year for obvious reasons. And I think that's a good thing for healthcare, but we want to make sure that we're complying with all the various rules and regulations, particularly around billing and reimbursement for that. And then other areas are going to be increased awareness, communication. You can't communicate enough, and I think we have a real opportunity there. But then also we have the blanket 1135 waivers that will come to an end whenever the declared emergencies come to an end. So we'll be watching for that. And there's going to be some re-education on some of those areas. For example, EMTALA, which I think we are still emphasizing, but I want to make sure that we haven't gotten lax on that once the waivers are over. So that will be a focus next year. And that is my report. I'm happy to take your questions.
Thank you, Dylan. Any questions?
Yeah, thank you, John. It was quite comprehensive.
It's a very good report. So thank you very much.
Thank you all.
If there's no further comments, then we will move on to the financial report with Tyler Freeman, our Chief Financial Officer. Welcome, Tyler.
Welcome. Good afternoon. So I did want to start off. I know Tom is no longer on the call, and Sasha is not on the call either. She's on some well-deserved PTO today. But I did want to say, just because of my background in public accounting, I know all of the questions that would have come out of 2020. You're trying to form an opinion on financial statements that look drastically different than your expectations, and different than all trends and all indicators would have told you they would have looked prior to 2020. So that led to a significant amount of work being done by DZA and a significant amount of responses needed from the accounting team. So, you know, great job on both ends to come to the conclusion that we came to. But I know it was a lot of work from both parties, having been on both sides. So, looking at 2021, if you want to flip ahead to the next slide, June was a very positive month for us. Our inpatient side started to catch up with how outpatient has been trending. We had a good month in terms of patient days. ICU patient days were up 19%, ACU up 9%, total patient days 7%. That included births were 22% above budget. We were at a total of 11 births for the month, and we projected out to have 9. So we were kind of positive in all areas on the stats department from the inpatient side of things. And then the outpatient side of the house is definitely still trending in a good direction. Surgery cases were up 23%, and surgery minutes were actually up 40%. So pretty significant month for surgery department. Looking at the diagnostic imaging, so overall, up 13%, and when you look at all the various categories, a lot of them were positive as well. So CT up 13%, diagnostic 14%, echo 37%, mammo 17%, and nuke med was up 46%. So a lot of areas with significant increase above our budget for the month of June. And also PT was up 5% overall. The PT department was 5%. OT was pretty flat, but then speech therapy was up 55%. And kind of going down into the rest of the numbers, ER 3% above budget. That ER and Express have not fared well overall in 2020 as compared to budget, but in June the numbers started to get back to our budgeted amounts. So all across the board, good numbers in June, which then led to, if you move ahead to our
Tyler
statement. Sorry, go ahead.
I have one question. It doesn't show on this graph, but the other one that was sent out on the statistics. South County visits were, you know, 40% of what we budgeted and about half of what they were last year. So are they just going someplace else?
I have a request out for some clarification on that, because I've noticed that South County has been low pretty consistently through the year. So I am waiting to hear back and receive clarification on if that is a budget thing or if that's a numbers thing.
So Tyler, this is Caitlin. I'm gonna jump in on behalf of Jen Wharton. We have a provider on leave for an extended period of time. And so we've been cutting and pasting, meaning sending providers from other areas to cover. But I think there's a pretty good chance that may be part of what is happening.
The other one that I noticed from the other sheet was on the sleep clinic and the sleep studies are about half of what we had last year.
Yeah, and that is the same situation. They have a, usually there's a 1.0 APP that's in that clinic and a 0.2 provider. And that APP has been out for, I believe, over a year now. And we did hire one that's started mid-July, I believe, about July 19th. So just a few weeks ago. So hopefully those numbers start to pick up for sleep because we should be fully staffed instead of where we were at before.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Overall, it's been a long time since we've seen that much green on the budget.
I know, and I always prefer green. It makes it easier to have these conversations. And Mari, it looks like you're on mute.
Yeah. Can I ask if the South County Clinic issue is going to be resolved soon, or what's the situation there?
I don't know if Caitlin has more on that. Like I said, I was reaching out and hadn't heard back that information yet. So Caitlin may have more.
The person remains on a protected leave, which means we're not backfilling that position. So I don't have an immediate answer for you.
While it's certainly the existing provider is optimal, I will tell you that the fill-in plan has been pretty robust with providers from Port Ludlow. So I given the circumstances and the challenges of a protected leave with respect to staffing dynamics, that I feel okay with how we are patching that hole. Like, I think as Tyler may have alluded to, this is a longer trend than just the provider leave situation. So that's probably the discussion that we need to have in terms of shrinking utilization of the clinic.
All right. And moving on to the income statement. So all of those green stats obviously led to a green gross patient service revenue as well. So 13% above budget for gross patient service revenue. We did have higher revenue adjustments in June. And a part of that is a little conservatism on our part because of some of the numbers that we're seeing in accounts receivable. So we have about 12% of our accounts receivable balance is over 180 days aged. At the end of 2020, that number was 5%. So we're starting to see accounts age out much longer, and this probably has to do with our collection practices at this time, and that's why we're doing that deep dive, and we're going to have more information in the September board meeting. But because of that, we want to be conservative. We don't, especially when accounts start to get that old, you definitely don't expect to receive the full balance that you would have expected before. So that is why revenue adjustments are also pretty considerably higher than they have been in the past, is accounting for some of that aged AR. We do see that other revenue was high as well for the month. This includes the $100,000 that we received per rural health clinic for the COVID testing and mitigation funds. So that is reflected in the other revenue balance. And then also included in other revenue is 340B revenue. 340B revenue was 40% above budget for the month of June. So again, coinciding with the rest of our statistics, 340B also did well in the month of June. Salaries and wages, 6% below budget. Some of the what's contributing to salaries and wages is the FTE number that we saw in the statistics. We are 5% lower for FTEs, but we do see a lot of premium pay as well going through, and that it has been about 3,000 hours of premium pay per month that we've been paying. And that's why year to date, our salaries and wages is still pretty even with what we've budgeted, even though we've had lower FTEs. But that does also kind of make our employee benefit number a little bit better, as having that not as many FTEs in those roles. But we would like to get those filled, especially speaking from the revenue cycle and the slide that John showed. There's been some positions that we are working to get filled, and we would like to have that FTE number be a little closer instead of under budget. Looking at the total number, the good month brought us to a total change in net position of 1.7 million. Pretty significantly above budget, and it also brought us into the black for the year. So now we're sitting at just over 1.7 million year to date for net income, and that's a little bit less than we budgeted. But looking at the stats down below, that's pretty close to where we wanted to be: 2.7% operating margin versus a budget of 3%, 2.5% total margin versus 3%. And the salaries and benefits are pretty close to where we wanted to land as well. Next slide. So the cash, as we've said before, we do have the $18 million that we received of CARES funding, and that's represented in that top green line of days cash on hand. We're doing pretty well from a cash perspective, so well that it's hard to notice that we've started to make those paybacks, but we have. We've started to pay back CMS, and we've paid $1.7 million through the month of June, and that will continue to be slowly paid out through the year. In terms of days in AR, holding pretty flat for the whole year, sitting right around that 45 number that we want to be at. So no concern from a cash or AR perspective. Next slide. And then for board financial report.
Excuse me, Tyler. Yeah, Kate, sir, could you say a little bit more about what the expected time frame is for that cash payback? Sounds like we've already paid a significant amount through June, but what is the anticipation of payback?
Yeah, so the way that payback works is for a period of time, we will withhold a 25% of our Medicare payment will just be held back. So it'll look as though we're receiving less money for the services that we're providing from Medicare as they withhold that to pay off the funds. After, I believe, 11 months, it transitions to, or 6 months, sorry, then it transitions to a 50% holdback for the next 12 months. So it should be about an 18-month period from the time this withhold started, which is around the end of May. And then that 4% would kick in, as Tom alluded to. If we hadn't paid all of it back through withholds at that point, they would require us to pay the remainder, or we would be subject to interest. And at that point, we would just pay the remainder off. We wouldn't pay the 4% interest on that.
Thank you.
And then for the board financials, nothing really to talk about here. We do have the audit fees from DZA are in there. If they look higher than budget now, it's because they're going to continue to have additional budget added throughout the rest of the year. We did also have the single audit, as Tom spoke about, for the FEMA funds that we had received. So there's more audit procedures than had happened in the prior year that were occurring in 2020 or for 2020. Next slide. And then July. July is looking positive as well. So right now we're projecting to be at 104% of budget for revenue. Cash collections are looking strong, and days in AR is also exactly where we want it to be. So hopefully we're out of the woods and kind of trending in a positive direction from here on out. Any questions?
Well, I have a comment. Let's have more of these.
I agree.
So are there any more comments or questions? I'm sorry, I received a phone call that I shouldn't have seen. Anyway, are there any more comments? I see Mari has her hand up.
I just assume that when we're doing the budget for next year for the board, that the extra audit will be taken into account and budget adjusted.
Yes.
Appropriately. Thanks very much.
Yep.
But good job, everybody.
Anyone else? All right, then. Thank you very much, Tyler. And we'll see you next month.
All right. Thank you. Now go into
the administrative report. Mike Glenn, our Chief Executive Officer.
Thanks, Jill. Sure. Next slide, please. So this is our vaccination update, and I'm just going to kind of cruise at a high level over this slide, because I think Dr. Mattern plans to spend a portion of his CMO update on what's happening with COVID in our community and some of the implications of that. But what I will bring your attention to is the daily vaccinations over the last 3 weeks. The bar graph on the bottom left of the slide, those are the vaccinations that we are giving either in the emergency department or mostly the express clinic or the primary care clinics. And it continues to be anywhere between 3 to 12 per day. But this is part of our attempt to meet our community where they are at and reduce barriers for getting a shot, at least within the system. Secondly, I just wanted to make the comment that that the J&J vaccine works better for these sort of impromptu. I'm around the hospital. Can I stop in and get a vaccination? I'm finally ready, because it is one and done. The J&J supply, due to manufacturing issues back east, is dwindling, and the big lot that most organizations have now is set to expire. Its efficacy is set to expire. Probably in the next week or so, and there's some discussion about the FDA extending that expiration date. But a complication in our reducing of barriers and putting shots in arms is that we may have limited to very little to zero supply of the J&J vaccine. And when I say we, organizations across the Northwest, because the national supply is in arrears. So that's kind of a bummer, but we will offer the J&J shot, and hopefully the FDA will extend the expiration date on the vaccine. And if they don't, we will absolutely make the Moderna and Pfizer, probably just Moderna vaccination available to to any patient that wants it. Next slide, please. So I'll roll through some volume slides. The slide to the left of the screen, the blue and the brown one, that represents our phone line, And the reason the volumes all but disappeared, did disappear the last couple of weeks, is that as part of the transition we were working on with the public health department, we were shifting the function of sort of the COVID hotline from a Jefferson Healthcare RN to the public health department. And frankly, where we were at a month ago, that seemed like a reasonable thing. Calls were reducing and changing in nature. So middle of June, we sort of just switched to the nurse hotline was for internal purposes only. Recently, there's been a big surge in hotline activity, both at the health department, sort of overwhelming that resource, and just all through the hospital because of the increased interest in testing and disease prevalence. So we made the decision yesterday at SLG to once again expand that hotline service. We kept the hotline nurses on duty, but just now once again expanded their responsibilities to community hotline service, and we will change how we are communicating that to say so. It was part of our what we called our deconstructing our COVID apparatus and embedding it into our day-to-day operations, thinking that COVID is not going to go away, but we need to make it a part of our daily activity. And that worked fine when the daily COVID activity was very, very small. Recently, it's been accelerating, and for the very purpose we set up that hotline, and it served the community very well, we are reestablishing it. So expect those numbers and our service to the any interested caller to go up. And then the same is true with the graph with the light blue bars or the turquoise colored bars, where they are all represent drive-through testing. And the testing had been reduced to about 100 for several weeks in a row, which mostly just captured our pre-procedure testing, which we continue to do, and some symptomatic. Well, the symptomatic testing is starting to increase again, and we reduced the days open of the drive-through clinic from 7 to 5 days, which worked fine when volumes were down and most of the tests were for pre-procedures. However, what's happening now is there's some confusion in the community over where to get tests. Unlike other communities, there are not convenient pharmacy drive-through where the kits are available, and the health department is really not set up to do this either. So we are in the process of increasing availability of our drive-through testing again from 5 days to 7 days, and we will make it available for symptomatic patients. We won't make it available for I have to have a negative test in order to fly to Maui, but we will make it. We will send those people to Walgreens or Rite Aid or some other mechanism. But if someone in the community is symptomatic and needs a clinical rule in or rule out of the Delta, or excuse me, the COVID, COVID-19, we will absolutely provide that. So those numbers shall be increasing, and an explanation for why they reduced. Next slide.
Mike, could I ask a question about that?
Sure.
So does somebody need to Do they just say they have symptoms, or do they need to talk or see a nurse, or do they get screened at all for symptoms before they get tested?
Yeah, the system that we set up that works so well was the nurse hotline. We'd encourage people to call the nurse hotline, or when people contacted us about a test, we would refer them to the nurse hotline, and the nurse hotline would, absent of someone being very, very, very sick and need of an emergent clinical intervention, the nurse hotline would schedule a drive-through test, and it would start there. So and now that we're able to turn the tests around in 7 hours, if the test comes back, if the patient believes they need a clinic visit, we now have knowledge of whether the patient is positive or negative before that visit, which just makes for, I think, a little less anxiety in taking care of them. So I think the way the workflow will work is encouraging the nurse hotline is sort of the funnel, encouraging all people who have questions or concerns to go through that. You have to have symptoms. You don't have to have a Jefferson Healthcare doctor to be able to go through the drive-through. And then when the test results come back, the next steps of that patient's treatment will be determined.
Thank you.
Yep. So, and I think the bottom line to that is, this seems sort of herky-jerky to us, to use a, a technical hospital administration term, because we had a very busy month last month, and resources that we are being used for these services, we need to use in other services. But the reality of COVID activity in our community really dictates what our system design looks like. So we will stand these up, and I would not surprise me if we go through the notion of winding down and then standing back up again and winding down as we work through this this crazy pandemic. Primary care and specialty clinic volumes, right about at 94%. The primary care side, very busy in the specialty clinic side. Probably primary care, some vacations that result in below 100% volume. But that's okay. That when the rest of the house is so crazy busy, that you have months or weeks where you're significantly over budget, it's okay to have a little bit of breathing room with volume, certainly. So I don't look at that with great concern, but just how the patients appear to be showing up. Next slide, please. And our oncology visits and our surgery volumes, actually surgery bounced back in a big way the last 2 weeks of July. July ended up being a very busy surgery month. And I think the same is true with cancer. Looks like we just captured the first week of oncology visits. Next slide. And this is probably, I think Tyler alluded to this, but this is the chart that shows emergency department, express clinic, emergency department in blue, express clinic in amber. But you'll see that our volumes for July, June and July are at or have exceeded our volumes. I think that's before COVID hit, although I'm not certain. But we're up to, I was talking with Kent Smith yesterday, and we're up to about 1,100 visits a month now. And we're, you know, we're actually talking about and have authorized additional provider time to help with those big spikes in the emergency department when they see, because, you know, unfortunately, 1,100 visits a month doesn't equate to, you know, 30 visits every day spaced out perfectly. They have some days where they see 12 to 15 patients or 18 to 20 patients, and then some days where they just get run over. And so we have developed a staffing plan that will provide another provider when we predict or are experiencing those days. And with respect to Express, probably the biggest driver to standing up the hotline number again and extending the days and hours of the drive-through test station is part of our embedding these services and living with COVID plan was that we would use the Express Clinic for the occasional test. And for the occasional test and lower than average volumes, that worked. However, if there was an uptick in test demand and a lessening of test availability, more and more people found themselves to the Express Clinic and with symptoms, not knowing their status, asking for a test. So it really flew in the face of how we have set up our COVID delivery system up to this point, where we try to keep the patient isolated when we can until COVID status is known. So I think that these climbing volumes in Express Clinic and the concern about more and more potentially positive COVID patients coming through COVID led to us making the, I think, real quick decision to reestablish our COVID service framework. Next slide, please. Okay, I mostly spoke to this during my first 15 minutes with you, but I kept it on the board my administrator's report because I think Alyssa reminded me that I told you that I would give you an update in July. But for the if it's okay with the board, I will just defer to the third on this when or the ninth, Monday the ninth, where I'll go into greater detail about project update, the two phases or potentially one bigger phase. And a discussion about the overall master site plan.
Does anyone have any comments or questions about that? Okay.
Sounds like very appropriate.
Work. Thank you. Next slide, please. So the really exciting news for our community is the QFC, what they call it, I think they're calling it the Seventh Haven housing complex. Formally, well, they celebrated the groundbreaking last week, and the official groundbreaking, the type that occurs with a backhoe, I think will begin sometime in August. So that's good. The implication of that is, as many of you know, our lease, we were 2 years into a 5-year lease with the county to provide what largely amounted to the administration parking lot. When the project came together, we agreed to forfeit our lease, and the county was awesome and refunded us the portion of the upfront dollars that we paid, but it required us to go find more parking. So on the left of the screen is the QFC lot in red that we are losing. On the right of the screen is staff parking The parking that Chris O'Higgins and his team, you know, turned around almost overnight, where we have mothballed the vaccination drive-through station because I'm not entirely convinced there won't be maybe the need for surge that booster vaccinations at some point. So we're going to keep that intact, but in the interim, use it for staff parking and in effect replace the QFC lot with those spaces. In addition, just below that and to the left where it says staff parking, we have a great relationship with Ravine, the owner of Manresa Castle. I mean, he's a there are neighbors and then there are great neighbors. Ravine's a great neighbor. And we have leased the back portion of the Manresa parking lot, Castle parking lot for staff too. And we just got the go ahead on if you have been in the waterside parking lot, we cut in some spaces kind of just with temporary permanent spaces furthest away from the hospital and closest to the water. Aaron Ballard and Chris and his team with some engineering and some pretty ingenuitive fill are able to drop the fill in, level more of that space and get another 20 spaces. So we believe that we've patched together enough parking going forward to more than make up for the spaces that we will lose in the QFC lot. And you know, it might seem a little odd for the CEO to be talking to the board about parking, but I tell you what, I mean, there are issues, and then there's parking shortage, and we've been fretting this for quite some time because some of the other options we considered were determined to be not viable. So we're really happy this came together, and we're watching it closely, and I think we're going to be okay. Next slide, please. So I wanted to talk with you about vaccinations because there is a lot of activity going on now at the international level, the national level, and the regional level. And I think with the advent of the fourth wave being driven by the Delta variant, and the seemingly correlation between increasing breakthrough cases and more and more Delta infection, municipalities and healthcare organizations are re-looking at their vaccination strategy. And our strategy to this point has been do everything in our power to make the vaccine available, answer any and all questions and educate employees, make available our providers to answer any questions, and just encourage and meet our employees where they are at. There's beginning to be discussion now at the American Hospital Association level, and this here is a proclamation that they recently passed that urges healthcare systems and hospitals to consider vaccination requirement. The Washington State Hospital Association board followed suit with a proclamation urging hospitals to require vaccination. You want to hit that next slide, Alyssa? Adopt a policy that healthcare workers shall be vaccinated against COVID-19. If they're not vaccinated, take alternative steps as determined by the hospital's infection control, human resources, and other relevant policies. And we are beginning to see hospitals in the state of Washington move rapidly in this direction. And I do think it's a direction or a movement that is considering all of the implications, which are real, is being driven by just what's happening in our state and in our community, and particularly in our healthcare community. Dr. Mannern is likely going to go into this more. Next slide, please. I wanted to inform you that Jefferson Healthcare's Strategic Leadership Group, and I think you know this, but Dr. Mannern has always been on SLG, but Drs. Butterfield and Dr. Harris, are on SLG. We have begun a discussion about a vaccination mandate at Jefferson Healthcare, and we plan for it to be a very deliberate, considering all of the issues, but driven by the question of, are we doing everything in our power to keep our employees, our patients, and our community safe from a disease that appears to be significantly different today than it was 18 months ago. So the discussion has begun. We plan to talk about it at SLG retreat, which is next Tuesday. I will likely give you an update at our retreat on the 9th. And while no decision has been made on this or a recommendation to the board, I will tell you that we're pretty serious about a thoughtful discussion and making an active decision on whether this is a good fit for our community or not. So just a heads up and an update at this point. I'm more room and space to talk about this in a week, but I'm happy to entertain any comments, and or if you have clinical questions, I may defer those to Joe's presentation here in a minute.
I'm assuming that the decision, first of all, I appreciate your careful review of the question. And I'm assuming that would be an administrative decision and not a board decision. Am I understanding that correctly?
Technically, yes. There are black and white issues of this is in my lane and this is in the board's lane. And then there are issues that, due to their implications or their importance or their level of interest, while it probably is an administrative decision, I would certainly want the board to be aware and comfortable with what we're doing.
Okay. That sounds fair.
I agree with that. Any other questions, comments? Okay.
My hunch is you'll this topic will may or may not come up if when Dr. Mannern gives his presentation. But anyway, if you have a question comes to mind later on in the meeting, I'm sure Joe can answer far better than I. Next slide. So a completely different issue, and maybe I should have staged these top agenda topics better. But as we have been working on our IHI equity work commitment, several hospitals back east were encouraged, and through the work that they were doing, identified parts of their history or their footprint in the community that needed to, at a minimum, be acknowledged. And I think some hospitals back east had more than, they felt the need to do more than that because of policies that they had made relative to treating different parts of the population differently. And they did thoughtful work and continue to do that work. Well, when we applied that to Jefferson Healthcare and Jefferson County and Port Townsend, what did emerge is the fact that that Jefferson Healthcare sits on land that was once the ancestral and contemporary homelands of several tribes and our indigenous nations. And we reached out to some of the indigenous nations around us and talked with them about this, and they were gave thoughtful responses that, you know, if I may boil them down, is it was like, well, you don't feel like you need to do this for us, but we appreciate the gesture, and we appreciate the consideration, and seemed to show appreciation that that the sensitivity was there. So what I wanted to propose for your consideration is a statement that we put on our website, possibly on your board packet. We can talk more about where this statement can and should go if we decide to proceed with it, that basically acknowledges that we are on the homelands of the Tsklallam and the Chemicum and the Twana and other indigenous nation tribal lands, and that we recognize tribal sovereignty across the region. Our small work group thought that was an appropriate place to start as we sort of continue to do this work. So this is the first time you're seeing this. Case would probably recognize that it's in the spirit of the exercise that we're going through. Dunya and some members of her team were helpful in this, and I wanted to put it in front of the board to get your comments, get your feedback, to see if you would want to work more on the statement or really anything else. This is just sort of introducing this as something that felt appropriate to staff.
Comments? Well, I think it's very appropriate. We are. I mean, it's the truth. And I think it's a good move. What other comments?
Yes. First of all, I want to thank the leadership group for having pursued this. This is something that's actually been on my agenda ever since we began the work on the health equity resolution, which I can hardly believe was, I think, more than a year ago, if I'm not mistaken. I'd like to recommend that we put this on our retreat agenda. There are some other parts to it that I would like to have us consider, but I think this is a great time to do it, and I look forward to the discussion about it.
That's great. That's a great outcome from my perspective.
Alyssa, will you please make a on that down on the agenda?
Yes.
Thank you. Any other comment? Okay. Thank you, Mark.
All right. Thank you. That concludes my my report, and
Okay, any other questions or comments generally on Mike's report? Okay, well, thank you, Mike, for another excellent report.
You're welcome.
A lot of territory on this one. Thank you. And now we'll move on to our Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Joe Mattern, for his report.
Well, I was that was a nice way for Mike to end, and I'm going to quickly take us back to a darker place, kind of where he was earlier in his presentation. So, but I love us working in some of that language and equity work any chance we get. You know, I think I'm not going to really give you a lot more new. I'm really just going to emphasize quite a bit of what Mike said. And in fact, I'm going to give a pretty quick report because for leaders on this call, I'm going to let you know that we're actually going to be calling an incident command after the commissioner meeting is complete. So I'll be looking to kind of round up some of the leaders because of the situation right now in the region as far as hospital bed availability that we're seeing. Just so you're all aware, currently we have several hospitals on divert, including St. Michael's, who are actually diverting some patients back toward us. University of Washington's on an internal disaster right now because of patients that are boarding in the emergency department. Sounds like transfers to Swedish and Virginia Mason are difficult right now. And what we're seeing across the area is it's not just COVID, but certainly we're seeing the effects of what is really the next wave of COVID, somewhat driven by the Delta variant, but not completely. I think many of you are aware of the COVID cases rising across the peninsula right now. Jefferson County certainly has seen some. We've seen outbreaks in our neighboring counties, including Clallam. We do have documented Delta variant outbreak in Clallam County. And so that means that even if cases that have been genotyped out of Jefferson County, if they have not genotyped for Delta variant yet, it's just a matter of time. It's becoming the predominant variant. And so I think to Mike's point, we're really dealing with a different disease. As cases go up, you will see, even for the vaccinated individuals, breakthrough infections. And so we had, you may be aware, we had one employee in the last 2 weeks who did test positive. In our case investigation, we believe that vaccinated employee contracted outside of work, did not have exposure. And we actually, again, abundance of caution to make sure that we maintain a safe workplace. We tested a number of employees who had contact with that individual, and happy to report all negative tests, over 30 people tested with negative tests. But the warning signs are flashing at us. And I think one of the most concerning things in the last couple of weeks was learning about an outbreak in Southwest Washington at the Peace Health Hospital, where there was an outbreak among employees and patients, including four vaccinated individuals, and showing you that despite, you know, even at this point in the pandemic, we can still see outbreaks in healthcare facilities, even with all of our precautions. So I think this is our next challenge. So, right, every time we kind of get to a new place, we reevaluate, we dial up, we dial down, we deconstruct, we reconstruct, or we redevelop. And right now, the focus of the team is exactly to ramp back up things that we know work. So Mike mentioned nursing hotline, our testing program. We have some ways to actually improve on our testing program. Actually, some of the good news is that we have the capacity to do more tests in-house rather than send out because of improvement in supply chain. We have the reagent to use our own machine so we can get quicker turnaround. However, I will tell you, if we do 100 tests in a day, which was something you know we were seeing in the last week on a couple days, we'll still need to send out at that volume because it actually exceeds what we can do on our own machine. But we do have the ability to do more in-house, which is great. We are in good shape with our PPE supplies and supply chain. So we're not at the same point as 18 months ago. So we're looking at a new version of the disease, but we're also at a different level of preparedness and planning than we were before. But to Mike's point, we do need to go back to improving the capacity and some things that we were able to dial down for a while. As always, the trick is to not decrease, you know, what we had to do over a year ago where we really decreased our capacity in other ways. We're seeing pent up need for medical care. So those increased surgical minutes, those increased visits and utilization, we're seeing things in situations that that were put off. And right now, one of the reasons that this group is going to get together after this commissioner meeting and game plan is we have an emergency department currently that is extremely full. And we've got ambulances coming in. Some of those patients that are currently in our emergency department will be getting evaluated and tested possibly with COVID-like symptoms. But we're also seeing plenty of non-COVID issues that are arriving today, and that's how it's been for the last few weeks. And so not seeing any let up at this point. So I think the big challenge for us is going to be, you know, what's our next move to keep our community safe, keep our employees safe. We had gradually been relaxing some of our approaches, visitor policy, some relaxing on masking for vaccinated individuals. Everything is up for review again. You know, we're going to look at everything. And I think that leads to the discussion around the vaccine mandate. Because while we are seeing breakthrough cases as far as infections, people who are getting COVID infection, what we are not seeing, what is the rare thing, is the vaccinated individual who needs the hospitalization. Again, when we look at who is ending up in our hospital and who is ending up very sick and who is still dying from this disease, this is still a disease of the unvaccinated. But we do appreciate now that with the Delta variant, we'll probably see some more breakthrough vaccinations. But vaccinations are still our number one layer of protection. And so this is, you know, this is leading to some urgency, which is, if we're not all vaccinated, do we need another level of standard for our protective equipment? Do we need more use of N95 masks in individuals who are unvaccinated? So these things are on the table, and we're going to continue to adapt the way that we have all through the pandemic. But right now, the primary goal should be still for the community and for our own workers, of people who have not gotten vaccinated, is to get their primary vaccination. I know there's talk of the need for the booster dose, but again, while there is some waning immunity, the individuals, again, who we're seeing hospitalized and dying from this disease are not individuals who need a third dose of Pfizer. They're the individuals who need their first and second doses of Pfizer, their first and second doses of Moderna. And so that still needs to be the focus of our efforts. So I think Mike mentioned that, yes, we will look at our spaces and we may need to consider a booster dose at some point, but right now the priority still needs to be getting primary immunization of the other individuals in our community who have not received it yet, and then we will use other strategies as are appropriate. So that's kind of where we're at. I'd love to talk about something other than COVID, but it really doesn't seem appropriate. And it's amazing, kind of even in a 1 to 2 week period, how the tone of things has changed, and just what we're seeing, how quickly, you know, we're seeing hospital beds full up and activity, and then this, you know, some portion of it being really the significant illness in the unvaccinated population. So I will stop. That is my, you know, formal report, but I am happy to answer questions for folks.
Thank you, Dr. Murray.
Yeah, Joe, do you think that if the vaccines are fully approved by the FDA, and I believe it's only paperwork that's stopping that at the moment, do you think that would engage more people in getting vaccinated?
You know, I think probably a small number are kind of waiting for that final approval. But what I find is we still have the hesitant folks who aren't, you know, aren't COVID deniers. They're not saying that the disease doesn't exist. They've been believing that, particularly as cases were going down, that they could put it off a little bit longer. They could delay. And what they're going to find is that the ability to delay longer and to wait for you're correct, is really primarily an administrative check mark at this point. You're gonna just significantly increase your risk of infection at this point. I find that there's still fear, a lot of misinformation. You have every major medical society and nursing society, people who have, you know, dedicated their lives and taken oaths to recommend and guide individuals to path to better health and to protect themselves, saying this is the right thing to do. And people are finding the information to support what is really, in a lot of cases, still fear of the vaccine. There will be unknowns, of course, about the vaccine how do we know in 3 years that there's not a problem with the vaccine? We can't speed forward, but we know the harm that the disease is causing, and we don't have a precedent for a vaccine causing harm and injury 2, 3, 5 years later. This is why it's not hard for the medical societies and healthcare professionals to come together and say, this is the right thing. This is our best tool at the end of the day.
Thank you.
Dr. Mattern, you mentioned that the several hospitals were on the verge. Was that primarily because of the Delta variant, or are they, like us, also having an influx of pent-up demand for that?
I believe it's combination. We did get some report from our local health officers that certainly they're seeing increase of Delta as well as Gamma variant in some of the areas. And so I know that some of what we're seeing is we're seeing some uptick in hospitalization if you look at the state data, but I think they're also experiencing a lot of what we're seeing, which is heart disease and cancer surgeries and other care that had been deferred. We're still seeing mental health issues, and we're still having difficulty finding mental health beds at different times. So I think it's a combination. It's not like what it was with our greatest peak and where the hospitalizations were at, but it certainly is providing a significant component. And I know in some places and some hospitals, it's making a bigger percentage. I think listening to the public radio report, they were discussing Walla Walla, which is actually experiencing where COVID cases are making a significant portion of their hospital beds right now. So, but I will tell you, it's interesting at this point in the pandemic that we've probably had 1 to 2 COVID patients in our hospital at any time over the last couple months. It seems like we'll send someone out and then we'll have another person that we're admitting and hospitalizing, and knock on wood, some difficult hospitalizations, but we're getting folks through. But These folks are looking at significant recovery and potential disability after hospitalized. So even when we don't see the mortality increase, we don't see death, we are seeing significant long-term consequences, including neurologic changes, changes to people's endocrine system, new onset diabetes, essentially a long COVID syndrome that has a variety of issues, including chronic respiratory difficulties and fatigue. So another piece of this pandemic that we will be coming to understand for years from now, which is the level of disability and impact.
Thank you.
Joe, this is Case. Do we have any information like a survey of those employees who are not vaccinated to understand their particular resistance? I know there are studies from around the country, but I'm wondering if our employees have been surveyed to see what their resistance is.
Yeah, we haven't gone to the granular level to see what's the final holdup. One of the things that's interesting when we report our vaccination rate is what I would tell you is that we are 80.5% confirmed vaccination. We have a small number of confirmed non-vaccinated, and what we have is a large portion of people who have not voluntarily provide us a documentation of their vaccination status one way or another. So we anticipate, because some of those employees are still part-time or per diem and don't work here as frequently, that some of those individuals are vaccinated and likely have just not provided the documentation. The next step really truly is going to the next granular level and understanding, I think particularly as we approach the idea of something like a vaccine mandate. I can tell you a probably count on one hand aware of some medical issues around allergy and reaction and maybe not being able to complete a vaccine series. So there will be a few employees that may not be appropriate, but all the more reason why we always have that. That's always an issue with any vaccination, and that's why you need the rest of your staff to be vaccinated because there will be always a small sliver of some medical contraindication. So getting to the heart of who's remaining and I think this is the thing that a lot of hospitals are facing and why they want to go as a group is that hospitals are facing a staffing issue. And if you draw that line in the sand, you have to be sure that you have a plan to make sure that you're not going to lose critical infrastructure if people simply that is a place that they're not willing to go. So I think that's part of the thoughtful planning of what are the implications if you finally pick a date and say after this time we're moving forward.
Bruce, you had a question?
Yeah, Joe, so far have we had any requests from other hospitals to transfer patients to us because they don't have a capacity?
I know that we're currently receiving a diverted patient from, I think, Kitsap County right now that they can't take. So we haven't had, if you remember, kind of our emergency planning of, when we had our COVID surge plan, potentially reallocation of patients from Seattle to smaller hospitals. So not having that at this point. So I think it feels like the bigger hospitals are trying to work through this surge right now, but we'll have to kind of see where things go from here.
Yeah, Joe, let me give you some data to provide some context for the board. Currently, St. Michael's, they're officially on ED diversion, which means that EMS is not supposed to go there. They have 81 patients in their emergency department, 27 inpatient boarders. So 27 patients that are boarding, waiting for an inpatient bed to open up, and 35 patients in the waiting room. So it's about as messy as as I have seen it. And we've been just living with Seattle hospitals and very limited availability and the implications around transfers for weeks. But this appears to be as bad as it gets. And I truly don't think that, you know, we are early on in the proliferation of COVID positive tests, but hospital days follow, you know, 3 to 4 weeks frequently behind, or maybe with Delta 2 to 3 weeks behind. So I think this is going to get worse before it gets better.
Yeah, I think, you know, again, we're in a different place, PPE preparedness, you know, Mike's right, which is that we're going to be, we may be dusting off more than our than simply our testing and COVID nurse hotline, you know, off the shelf.
Mario, question.
What sort of capacity do we have to take several patients from outside the community, and so that we can still take care of our own patients if there's such a crunch?
Well, it all is going to just depend on hospital staffing. Right now, I'm just happy that we have another emergency room doctor who's coming in to double staff our ED, and so we'll just take these little battles. But you got to keep in mind that we have a lot of staff who had pent up PTO and, you know, were burnt out, and people taking their vacation, and so we have that kind of, you know, coinciding at a time, and I don't think we're alone in that. So staffing is really, one of the key things. We know how to, you know, upscale our space to create more capacity, but it's going to be about the people. So, and I think that'll be, you know, shift to shift, really, you know, so daytime's looking good. Earlier report was, you know, sort of nights staffing is going to be limited. Right now our inpatient census isn't bad, but I'm looking at the ED and knowing kind of a certain percentage. And so I won't be surprised if our census is significantly increased by tomorrow morning.
And so do I then understand that Gig Harbor and down the track towards Seattle, Tacoma, they're also in the same situation?
Yeah, I don't have a report on those, but typically, you know, as goes the I-5 corridor, you'll typically see some spillover into the Tacoma Olympia corridor as well. So we haven't gotten reports. We sometimes have been able to transfer patients down there when we haven't had luck within Seattle. So that's what you tend to do, is you start to look north. So you start to look Everett, or you start to look Olympia area. But I'm sure that'll be part of the team starting to look at what the capacity is across the region.
Yeah, I was thinking more of St. Michael's and CHI and sending them down to the other hospitals that they have down on 16 and...
Yeah, my guess is sort of south part of the county. That's probably what you're seeing, is some level of diversion in that direction. But I would guess that ambulances from North Olympic Peninsula, if possible, they're going to try and keep them up here in this part of the region.
There's that, and there's also, and we have benefited from this mostly, but Washington State has this unique, mostly informal, but all the hospitals agreed to it, that when things get that we won't let one hospital get overwhelmed. And initially that was implemented with respect to emergency PPE requirements or not being able to take care of COVID patients, because there are some really horrific stories coming out of Houston and other major metropolitan hospitals where the hospitals don't work. So there are actually organizations within the state that work closely with EMS and that we are talking with on a weekly basis that attempt to manage all of this. The unusual part is 99 times out of 100, 999 times out of 1,000, the ambulances are heading the other direction. So
the due diligence that we do, Mari, is, we check to see, you're on divert. What does that really mean? And I can assure you nearly every time that the conditions of the hospitals that are closing shop are tighter than ours. And that's, not much consolation to staff that are feeling the pinch, but it's pretty cool the way that the state works together to try to take care of all residents, kind of regardless of the community or even region.
Great.
Just want to make a point to that capacity that I think first place that most of us think, and appropriately so, when we think about vaccination of our employees, is we think about protecting patients, right? And protecting one another. It's about readiness, really, too. It's about protecting your workforce and the implications for being vaccinated and having exposures and staying home from work and quarantine isolation are different. And decreasing your chance of illness overall. And so part of one of the reasons that, hospitals have to look at some point, do we need the mandate, is just emergency readiness, that we can't have a workforce and we see that now, just with an increase in cold viruses that are not COVID that we've seen across the community, as people have started to move around in the last 4-6 weeks, we have to take those seriously and we have to test people. And we definitely need the people vaccinated. So we also aren't looking at 10 to 14 day loss of people in critical areas.
Okay, any other questions, comments? Thank you, Dr. Matter. Very comprehensive report.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, then we will go on to board business. We have a Board of Health report, Case.
Thank you. I'll keep this very, very brief because I did send a very extensive report to the board a week or so ago. And I'll just mention that there are two very new top-notch positions at Public Health. One, as you know, Dr. Tom Locke is retiring as the public health officer, and he has helped us recruit an outstanding replacement in Dr. Allison Berry, who has started, and Dr. Locke will continue to be the deputy health officer for both this county and for Clallam County, where he already serves as the deputy health officer. And then the second one is Vicki Kirkpatrick, who was the director of public health, has retired. And she is being replaced by an outstanding individual. They looked outside and inside the organization. And I think we are all delighted, all of us associated with public health, to hear that Apple Martin, who has been working at the health department for the last couple of years, is now the director of public health. And she is absolutely outstanding. And so I think that there will not be a significant lapse in services because the two people who are now in these two leadership positions are fully trained, very comfortable and confident with how things are working in Jefferson County. So it's I'm delighted to report that, and I won't say anything more.
Certainly sad to see Dr. Locke going and Vicki as well, but glad to hear that there are new people that are going to fill those shoes.
Yes, and I think they'll fill them very well. And let me just remind everyone that Dr. Locke was actually planning to retire 2 years ago, and it's because of the pandemic that he decided to stay on. And he felt that things were far enough along at this point that he could successfully transfer his responsibilities to Dr. Berry. And I think he's right. She's been in the Clallam County public health officer for the last couple of years, and she shares all of the dedication, values, and everything that Dr. Locke has. So I think it's a good decision on his part. We wish him all well, and we'll still see him occasionally as the deputy health officer.
Thank you, Mari.
Yes. So, are we sharing Dr. Berry with Callum still, or in the future, or is she just ours?
That is correct. We're sharing her in much the same way that Dr. Locke performed the public health officer duties for many years for both counties simultaneously. And so she's taking over doing that and will continue to work at the Jamestown Family Clinic, where her specialty happens to be LGBTQ healthcare, addiction prevention and treatment, and reproductive health. So she'll continue to have her hands in medicine. And she's a family physician trained here in family medicine at the University of Washington in Harborview.
Just a comment on how smooth that transition is going. Dr. Locke has included Dr. Berry in the last three of our incident command meetings, and everything a case has described her with is absolutely what we're seeing. The transition is seamless. Not only is she up to speed on Jefferson healthcare issues, but her in-depth knowledge of what's going on in Clallam has been wonderful. And she just seems like she's going to be a great member of the team. So kudos to Dr. Locke for assisting with the transition, and kudos to the health department and the board for moving rapidly to do this, because I think it's a great choice.
Good news. Good news.
And let me also say, she also has significant leadership at the state level. I think starting next year, she will be president of the State Public Health Officers Association. So again, she's just dynamite on all fronts.
All right. Okay, is there any other board business? All right, if there's no other board business, then we will go ahead and go to our meeting evaluation. So, Mari, would you like to start?
Yes. I think we had a great audit report and also a great monthly update from Tyler. And I'm very happy that it's a lot more green than the red that we've been seeing. And extremely informative meeting, and somewhat concerning some of the issues with COVID increasing and the crunch on beds around the region. But I think very informative and very enlightening. And thanks to everybody who and also to our leaders and teams of the month, of the quarter, rather. Great.
Okay. Bruce?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what Mari said. I mean, good and positive reports all the way around, except for Dr. Mattern's report. That it's out of his control. And I look forward to our retreat on the 9th.
Case?
Well, first of all, I agree with what everyone else has said so far. I usually complain about not having enough time for us to have some in-depth discussions, but that wind has been taken out of my sail now that we have a retreat. And so I won't make that statement this time, and the reports really are all very important and very well done.
Matt?
Yeah, it was a good meeting. I agree with what's been said.
Case, can you mute? Thanks. Yeah.
I'm particularly really pleased to see what's coming out of the equity group and the this, you know, considering a statement related to Indigenous tribes. And hopefully, you know, the city of Fort Townsend is also doing that kind of work, because this town definitely has a history that could use some reconciliation. So yeah, that's all.
Okay, and I can't add anything more than everybody's already said, but I agree with it all. So thank you, everyone. Mike, do you have anything that you'd like to add?
No, other than Dr. Mattern's presentation was a buzzkill for me too. It's just remarkable how things have changed in a week. I mean, and this appears to be, and you know, it's an N of 4 or 5 days, but it almost appears that the madness, the COVID-related madness that we have seen in other communities has penetrated our bubble here. But it's early, a lot of activity now, and maybe it'll quickly diminish, but that on top of some pretty tired folks and this high level of alert that people have been on for other reasons for so long, man, timing couldn't be worse. But we'll work through it, and I'm sure I will report more at the retreat.
Thank you. I think there are some really wonderful things that are happening, really good things that we heard today, but that's got to be a definite downer. Okay, well, how about a motion to conclude?
So move.
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Okay. Bye, everyone. See you on the 9th.